Blog Talk Radio.
Gordon of the National Black Teen Empowerment Expo and Unity Design, and as always, it's my pleasure to be your host for this broadcast, which is originally airing on June 26th, to Just the Freedom is Faith. With us tonight is a wonderful blogger and so much more, EcoSoul Intellectual, and we're going to discuss her fascinating controversial piece called Parallels Post-Reconstruction and Post-Obama Reconstruction Eras. Welcome to the Gist of Freedom of Faith, my sister.
Greetings. How are you doing today, brother? Thank you for having me. I'm honored, and I look forward
blessed.
To having
mm-hmm. Yes, we're blessed that you could join us. Now, let's set the stage accordingly, if you'd be so kind, by sharing with me and our listeners what the post-Reconstruction era embodied, what it was all about.
Okay, no problem. Well, I posted that last summer, July 2010, and I posted it because at the time, the Tea Party and their protests were at a height, and I began to see a lot of the right-wing conservative politicians and also just the people who represented that opposed Obama, but from the standpoint of a very racialized point of view. Obama hanging an effigy, Obama being compared to a monkey, Obama being called a Muslim, which is, of course, the at that point that was the key word for, or the another word for saying the N-word, and Michelle Obama being compared to a gorilla. And I was concerned because there's one thing of having political engagement and disagreeing with political policies with the administration, as we all do, but there's another thing when you oppose it just because the man is black and your rationale is based in historical racist tone and from a point of view. So that got me thinking that a lot of things that were being done in terms of creating the climate reminded me of the post-Reconstruction era. And for your listeners, the post-Reconstruction era is the era right after what is called the Reconstruction era. So after emancipation, the federal government then put in place policies and also backed it up by military to enfranchise black people. So in the late 1800s, you had universities and schools being built for black people, black people now being elected into Congress. You had black businesses being established, and it was all protected under the federal government. Well, that lasted roughly about 20 to 25 years. And then what you see towards the turn of the century, right, so going into the 1900s, you begin to see this massive anti-black movement that's going on by white America, particularly around economics, around sexual identity, around political power. And it was all framed within the mindset that black people were animalistic, that black people were overly sexual. No way that these type of people can hold political office, can hold a respectable business, and so on and so forth. And so I compare the two, and I'm really and in addition to the prison industrial complex that we have that is so racialized, and I said there's no difference. You know, there's no difference between what was going on in the late 1800s versus what's going on now, you know, in the beginning of, you know, this millennium.
And, you know, what's interesting is that in many ways it reminds me of affirmative action and to an extent even reparations for all the suffering prior to this point. But, you know, we did with some of these mandates truly flourish because there was Black Wall Street, for instance. And I think the backlash may have stemmed more from jealousy, for lack of a better word, among whites to see us excelling so quickly and so strongly because of some of these initiatives at the time.
One of, you know, I'm going to do another angle on that. In addition to what you said is that I think what we saw was that America still has a lot of issues with race. Right.
Of course.
And so,
right.
You know, and so what happened in my piece, I talked about there was an excellent, it was around 2005, there was an excellent traveling museum called, it was called like the Sanctuary, I believe, but it was a lynching museum. And it was actually based upon a book by a Jewish man who discovered, you know, years before that a family member of his had an heirloom. And the heirloom was is that the family member inherited some kind of lynching paraphernalia, and I forgot exactly what it was. And so he began to discover that a lot of white people were being passed down souvenirs from lynchings that took place in the 17, 18, and early 1900s. Anything from, like, postcards, because there were actually lynching postcards that were distributed
right.
in the United States, to actual embalmed body parts like testicles, eyes, fingers. There was even like a purse that was made out of the skin of a black man who was lynched. And so he, you know, out of this, seeing this atrocity, he began, you know, it inspired him to do this lynching museum to just talk about the lynchings that went on in America. And so what that was about, you know, in the 90s has happened. So these inheritances are just not physical. They're also ideological. They also are deeply cultural and embedded in the white consciousness. And I believe that what happened is that when masses of people feel like as if their privilege is revoked, the majority, this is a reflection of it. But I really like, so there's this guy by the name of Tim Wise, and I like what he says as well. He also says is that the status quo also plays upon people's fears. It also pumps an agenda that is actually against the masses of white folk and working class white folk that were out in these Tea Party protests and all this other stuff. It's actually against it. But they use this whole thing of like that white skin somehow denotes as some type of privilege in the United States. And also in post, I know I'm long-winded, so I'm so sorry. But also in post-Reconstruction, in terms of, it was called the Nader era, right? N-A-D-I-R, the Nader era. A lot of the atrocities carried out by poor white folk and working class white folks that felt that the black people who were getting their businesses and getting land and so on and so forth were competing with them economically. So here you have today, what do you have today, right? So I know I'm long-winded. I'm going roundabout to say that I think it's an inherited consciousness that we're also dealing with.
Right. Well, and let me let our listeners know that you have, a beautiful blog. The URL website address is ecosoulintellectual.blogspot.com, and we talk a little bit more about it. Let's fast forward and make the parallels between the post-Reconstruction era and the post-Obama Reconstruction era, as you so eloquently point out in your piece.
And let me just say this, and this is going to be very quickly, is that the reason why I call it a post-Obama, I call that specific article a post-Obama era is because that's what they said we were in. But really, we're really in a post-Bush regime era. You know, what a lot of people don't realize, we still are dealing with a lot of with the policies that Bush and the administration for 8 years put down.
That's right. So we're trying to clean up the mess in many ways.
Exactly.
Okay. And, you know, we can talk about, compare the 2008 election headlines to the current headlines. Would you like to speak about that a little bit? Would you like to talk about, you know, let's talk again more of the post-Obama Reconstruction era and put that into context for our listeners, if you'd be so kind.
Okay, well, the post-Obama era started, or that catchphrase started, especially in the whole, you know, in terms of in the blogosphere and in these in intellectual circles, to signify a period of time that was supposedly that because a black man, an African American man, had been elected into office, then America had really dealt with a serious issue on race, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So when Obama got elected, you saw several things in the media. And let me say, there, because I'm a media studies professor, there's the mainstream media, and then there's alternative media, other alternate media, right? So mainstream media was really pumping initially this whole idea that America finally stood as a unified country, right? And that Obama was this very clever, this very smart, this very ingenious man that mobilized the youth, that used technology, that raised money and raised a consciousness that had never been before. The only thing closest to that was Abraham Lincoln, right? So these are the things that are going on in early 2008. And also there was this climate of a drastic shift in public policy, political policy, and also a drastic shift in socially how we would deal. This is like the infant stages of the post-Obama era. But after that, we see a rise, and let me tell you, as a professor, I can clearly remember, like after Obama was elected, one of the universities that I was teaching at the time, there was a young lady who was she was a right-wing conservative, a very unapologetic. I remember her breaking down in class and saying that we were all going to go to hell and that we were all going to see like. This demon, this demagogue that was put into office, right? So shortly after, you have this kumbaya moment, for lack of a better word. Then you see the media then begin covering this funky little organization in South Florida that's funky, which we now know as the Tea Party. What's very interesting is that prior to the Obama election, like radical groups never really were covered in mainstream media. But very interestingly, you have this group that wants to take their country back. So now what you see in the mainstream media is a lot of attention on this organization. And as you know, when you provide exposure to things, it begins to grow. So then people and then this organization, as the media reports, begins to play on the fears of a white conscious America in terms of people losing their rights. In terms of also now you're going to have kind of like a colonized America or a reverse slavery system that's put in place. Where now you have the so-called white majority now being subjected to conditions that are akin to a Jim Crow era. So these are the things that are being pumped into mainstream media. Now, the mainstream media said that they didn't support this perspective, but they were giving it a lot of airtime, right? So this is going on in the post-Obama era. And I thought that was very interesting because never before had that really been put, not since the 70s, especially something as radical as this South Florida group.
Right, and let's tie it into today's headlines. I mean, we can talk about the attempted assassination of Senator Gifford. We can even talk about the Christie's educational reform. Let's talk about the parallels between the Jim Crow era and where we are now today in the post-Obama reconstruction,
okay.
Because in many ways it is a reconstruction because, again, he has to put the country back together after the Bush fiasco and even before that, right?
Right, and I must say this is that I've always, and I stand firm with this, is that we always must be critical of any administration. You know, working in politics, I know this is that politicians are nothing but figureheads, and it is the people that move. It is the people that should be moving them, right? So I'm saying that to say is that I have had serious critiques of some of the things that Obama has done. As an American, I should. You know what I mean? So I wanted to add that caveat before I talk about, I go into what we were saying. You were saying the post-construction of era and the parallels between, what was the...
I think there's a very strong parallel between the Jim Crow era and the post-Obama era,
right,
where we are today. When we talk about health reform, when we talk about the attempted assassination of Senator Gifford, you know, it's almost like we go full circle with some of this stuff.
Okay. Well, I know you've heard of it, but Michelle Alexander, very astute woman, she gave a speech at Riverside Baptist Church recently, which is in Harlem.
Right. The author, isn't that the author who talked about the parallels to Jim Crow today
with the prison corporations. Yes. And this is really an excellent, and I think this is an excellent conversation that needs to be taking place, but also action in it. Because the prison industry, she gives excellent, I was just checking her out, and I was like, right on, sister. She gives excellent examples. So what happened is after the emancipation, America was trying to figure out what to do with all these black people, right?
Right.
And
they were considering shipping us back, weren't they? I think that was Lincoln's idea, if I'm not mistaken.
Right, that was Lincoln, you know, to ship them back to America, right? And so, you know, Jim Crow was the Jim Crow laws had predecessors. You had what were called the slave codes, right? So the slave codes were rules that regulated black folks. So an example of the slave code, and it was during slavery, was that black people cannot gather together, ever, right? Right. So if a group of black people are gathering together, then they're the issue, which you can clearly see that goes on now.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Flash mob.
you know, that's still going on. Another slave code was that black people, a drum could not be played in public, and that's still on record, right? So a drum actually being played in a public, it could be, you know, you could be arrested. So after slavery ended, you had what was called black codes. So black codes were these informal, formal rules and regulations that black people had to observe, right? Especially, you know, for example, one of them is that a black person could not be in a white section of town after dark unless they had a pass that indicated that they were employers there, all right? So then after black codes came Jim Crow, right? So Jim Crow was the system, right? And so Michelle Alexander, she signifies the prison industrial system complex. And this is very interesting because after the Emancipation of America was figuring out what to do with all these black people, they began to actually en masse lock up black folks, black males, and juveniles. Because a lot of, you know, because of, as a result of slavery, a lot of families were, you know, disrupted. So you had a lot of orphans. So black people began to be criminalized then. And so she makes this really great, she threads really great piece to say that the first actual prison industrial complex was funded by black bodies, and it still is being funded by black bodies or fueled by black bodies. So that's a really glaring, that is really important when you look at disproportionately in cities where you have significant amounts of black folk, in those states, you have a disproportionate number of black people in jail, in prison, especially black men. Right? So a lot of things in terms of criminalizing black men in the post-Reconstruction era, today, black men are criminalized. When I ask my students, when you hear on the news, if you could close your eyes and you hear on the news, there was a shooting today in New York, what is the face that comes up? All right.
That's right. That's right.
Right.
Let me quickly just let our listeners know. Yes, can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay. You're listening to the Gist of Freedom is Faith. I'm going to ask you, good sister, if you can stay with us about another 15 minutes because this is such an engaging conversation. We don't want to let you go. Is that cool on your end?
I'm rolling. That is no problem. I'm here.
Okay. And let's talk a little bit about, and I'm with you. I think, again, the prison system today is nothing more than modern slavery revisited or slavery revisited. The correlation is indeed that strong, and I do a lot of work with black youth, so we're always trying to bend that pipeline somehow. I'm with you. Can you compare for us the Gifford attempted assassination to Sumner?
You know what? I have to admit, I didn't put that into the equation. I would really like to hear what your thoughts are on it.
Well, this is actually Leslie who was interested in this. And I don't know that I'm that knowledgeable to truly speak to it either. I tend to not read too much of the current news because it's usually blues and it's usually bad news. And I try to stay as positive as possible. But so let's get back into it.
Okay.
What are some of the other parallels that you've noted that you feel are prevalent when we look at post-Reconstruction and post-Obama and the post-Obama
media.
Era?
Right. Media. So let's get more into media. So in 1906. There was something called the Atlanta Riots, and in the Atlanta Riots started in downtown Atlanta, and there was and it started it started in downtown Atlanta, but it was fueled by months and months of the news of the local newspapers printing anti-black propaganda, and a lot of that was around pictorial images. So you know how you have the cartoon drawers.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the cartoons at the time were, for example, a black man trying to rape a white woman, or a black man as an elephant, or a big white man, you know, talking about how black people are going to steal all the jobs, right? So now it's very interesting when you look at a lot of the caricatures in the cartoons, in terms of the political cartoons around Obama. In terms of his physical features are more like monkey-like. They are animalistic and they're debasing. The cartoons that you see in mainstream are very conservative, are right-wing conservative consciousness in terms of here you have this black man that's going to take power or take control of you, much like the post-Reconstruction era. So in 1906, the Atlanta riots were fueled, and so, like, in this propaganda, and then one day a fight broke out, and, you know, a lot of the black communities in Atlanta were scorched, right? So black people had to flee. So media plays a really big part then and now in terms of consciousness. Hello?
Yeah, I'm here. I'm listening.
Oh, okay. Okay, okay.
Right, and I agree. And you mentioned earlier in the broadcast that media has flourished relative to non-traditional or alternative media is what I believe you called it. And mainstream media, which, as we well know, is controlled by maybe five or six major corporations who, in many ways, control what we see, control what we hear. And more often than not, it's a very limited perspective.
Right. And also what you hear in the media is you hear in the post-Obama era, you hear there's one thing of being a harsh critic of something, but there's another thing of personally attacking somebody.
Sure. Sure.
And so what I remember and this is not just even Obama. This is just not, and it's not just black people. It's people of color and poor folk. But more, let's talk about, I'm going to focus on people of color. So for example, Haiti and Katrina, they're the same, right? So when the earthquake happened in Haiti, I distinctly remember Pat Robertson getting on and saying that this is what Haiti deserved, that they're a devil worshipping country, and that they practice voodoo, and that this earthquake is a sign of God.
Right.
So, and then this same guy, during the Obama elections, he was on Fox News, and I forgot the young woman, the black woman's name, and they were in this political debate about Obama, and he tells the woman to shut up, right? So never before did you hear, like, these really virulent, like, nasty attacks, very much embedded in, like, a violent, racist mentality on the news. Right. That
right.
Prior to that, if you were saying that about Bush, well, the last year of Bush, you know, he was getting knocked around. For the most part, if you were to say that about Bush, your career would be over.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a lot of people's critique around Obama is beyond disrespectful. You know, it would be even considered in some ways. It would be you know, as if it's threatening the head of state. But this is being allowed now. You know, this is being allowed in this era.
Right, right. And I think in many ways, these personal attacks are nothing more than distractions or diversions to, as you suggest, the real issues that should be deemed more important.
Right, and the real issues, and I would like to, the real issues, I don't even think majority of the people who are at these protests even understand what the real issues are. That's the problem.
Well, and, you know, one of the things, you know, and it's interesting because on your website, and again, I want to share the link, ecosoulintellectual.blogspot.com, you have this wonderful photo of the first black United States senators elected in the late 1800s.
Right.
And I wonder what they were up against. I mean, it would be amazing to be able to clearly focus on this group and some of the challenges they had as black elected officials during that era. I can't even imagine that by and large.
I can definitely tell you a very interesting dynamic that was going on at that time, and that was actually around gender, right? So at this time where you have, you know, black people being able to be elected officials, black people being able to vote, at that time only men could vote, all right?
Right.
But also what was going on, at the time, you know, so Frederick Douglass was still alive during this period that I'm talking about. So there were, it was called the Universal Negro Improvement, the Negro Improvement and also Women's Improvement. So there was this big political discussion about who do we give, after emancipation, who do we give the right to vote, black men or women, all right? And, mm-hmm. you know, Frederick Douglass, who was a heavyweight, was actually, who's actually considered in the feminist world the first male feminist, because he was totally in support of women getting the right to vote. His stance was is that any person oppressed, if any person oppressed, male or female, means that we're all oppressed. That was his point of view. But when the conversation about who do we give the right to vote, black men or women, he said, hey, I got to go with black men. I got to go with black people finally being able to be articulate and discuss our point of view in this political arena. And mm-hmm. so the women, the white women, we're talking about the Susan B. Anthony's and the Cat and the Cat Berries at the time, you know, said publicly that, you know, how dare you, to their husbands and their uncles, how dare you give these, like, you know, apes, these animals, right, you know, to hold political office over us. They're uneducated, they're ignorant, and they're uncivilized. And so that was one of the things that the men were facing at that time, you know, so.
And I would suspect that Frederick Douglass had a role as a media mogul at that time, if I'm not mistaken. And I find it amazing that that these black senators were able to get enough votes at that time in that era to win these elections. It amazes me when you look at the dynamic of, again, a hostile white society and our first black senators in this country.
Right. Well, in place, the federal government made sure that there was fair representation during that election time. So it definitely was through the federal government and the protection of the federal government that it happened. And it's very interesting that, you know, the first, you know, black congressional political officers were from two states that today have some of the most repressive and oppressive conditions. That's Mississippi and South Carolina, right? Which back then were politically forward. You know, people might think, oh, it was New York and all that. No, it was Mississippi and South Carolina, right? And that was also because you had huge populations of black folks in Mississippi and South Carolina. As a matter of fact, Mississippi still has the most population of black people in any state in the United States, right? So, you know, that also plays into, you know, how these men, and also these men were statesmen already, you know, even if they were not, you know, political statesmen. They were very well educated, you know, they were professionals, and they were already part of the political discourse anyway. So, I mean, they, you know, there weren't, you know, people, you know, these guys that they just plucked and put, and they were made men. These were men who actually advocated and did work.
Mm. And let me, you know, you have a very interesting quote or paragraph here on the site when you talk about, though I am fervent in holding Obama accountable, I often must sit back and acknowledge the racial, gender, and classist dynamics at work in the public sphere. But what I see are systematic entrapments to disempower an effective leadership and the consciousness of country that not only believed, but knew there was a better way, and it did come. in a black face. I find that quite eloquent.
Thank you. I appreciate it. Sometimes I write better than I talk, right? You know, the reason why I said that was that I don't know if you remember this, but also what was going on was that there was this whole thing that, oh, black people, you know, the Republican Party was a party that emancipated black people, and it was a party of black people, you know, for a long time. We did all these progressive things for black people, and, you know, all that stuff was going on. So the reason why I said that is that as we're talking about how do we move forward in this country, I must always keep into mind that there are dynamics that are at play that are unseen that navigate how people move and think, and even myself, you know. Mm-hmm. So race, gender, class, these things move how people, and it's unfortunate that there are people who allow these superficialities to direct them in a direction that undermines them living healthy, beautiful, fruitful, productive lives.
That's right. That's right. And you know, when we look at Obama, and I often suggest that you can put a good captain on a bad ship, but we'll all still sink and drown. And that it's really not one man, black or otherwise. It's a machine that truly controls the inner workings of the society and country. And I'd like to get your final thoughts. We enjoy having you. We're going to have to certainly have you back, because I think we should have just scratched the surface in terms of this discussion. There's so many different arms and tentacles to it, if you will. But share with us, if you will, your final thoughts, and we're so grateful that you took some time to be with us tonight.
Okay, well, you know, thank you, Sister Leslie. I really appreciate being on. I'm just going to say what's been kind of going on in my mind, and you know, what's been going on is that I've been talking a lot about the Cornel West controversy. If you want to me, it wasn't even controversy. Is that I think, terms of, we want to talk about black folk, is that we are of a time where we are sophisticated enough into thinking where we can critique in a healthy way whoever is in office, and we suffer too much to allow anybody to just make a decision and be all right with this without engaging in meaningful discourse and also being active, you know. And, you know, I think, you know, my mom and I, we're in different generations. And, you know, she said, oh, I didn't like the way, you know, how Cornel West and other people, you know, air our dirty laundry, right? But at the end of the day, the dirty drawers got to get clean. We got to clean these dirty drawers, all right?
That's right. That's right. You know, Very well said.
You know, and so however we do it, of course we must do it with finesse and grace, but at the same time, we must understand that it is an ugly process.
Yes, yes. Well, you know, there's nothing we can't overcome together, but it seems that in this day and age, in many ways we've become very divisive even among ourselves, and I think that sometimes thwarts our overall progress as a people and planet. Again, thank you so much, my sister, for being with us. Let's plug the website one more time, ecosoulintellectual.blogspot.com. I encourage our listeners to check out her wonderful blog, stay abreast of this wonderful sister and her wonderful perspective. Again, thank you so much. In closing, let us remember the spirit of our greatness as embodied by those who paved the way for us. For in many ways, their souls still live within us. We hope by sharing their and these stories, we have helped to reawaken your strength and passion in their honor so that we are inspired to make history every day. Thank you for joining us on The Gist of Freedom is Faith. Good night, and God bless.